HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. At the Republican National Convention, an eagerly awaited speech by Senator J.D. Vance as he formally accepts the GOP vice presidential nomination. CBS's Natalie Brand.
Senator Vance has been a vocal critic of additional U.S. military aid for Ukraine, alarming some in the Republican Party. Vance has also made a journey from outspoken Trump critic to running mate.
Earlier, former Trump advisor Peter Navarro spoke after his release from prison earlier today on contempt of Congress charges.
If they can come for me, if they can come for Donald Trump, be careful, they will come for you.
CBS's Margaret Brennan reports on another special appearance at the Milwaukee convention.
The former president entering, as he does every night, as if it were a UFC fight, walking down the hallway, the long walk out to It's a Man's World.
Also today, President Biden has tested positive for COVID, has been given Paxlovid, and will self-isolate. CBS News Special Report, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Tomei Olson, here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Advocates are demanding an investigation into the deadly police shooting of a homeless man in Milwaukee. It happened outside the Republican National Convention perimeter. Five officers from Columbus, Ohio, shot and killed Samuel Sharp Jr. Milwaukee Police Chief Jeffrey Norman says Sharp was threatening someone with a knife.
Someone's life was in danger. These officers, who are not from this area, took upon themselves to act to save someone's life.
About 100 people came to a vigil for Sharp. There are hundreds of law enforcement officers from all over the country here in Wisconsin to help with the RNC. Now authorities will start an investigation into the deadly shooting. And Thursday is the final day of the Republican National Convention. We're expecting speeches from members of the Trump family. And then in the evening, former President Donald Trump is expected to give the keynote address formally accepting his party's nomination. And that's what you need to know. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. This is Civic Media News.
The Republican National Convention is in Milwaukee, putting Wisconsin in the spotlight. We're there to tell you what you need to know. I'm Civic Media News Director Terry Bell.
And I'm Todd Allball, host of The Todd Allball Show. Count on us for important analysis, interviews, and the Republicans' nomination of their presidential candidate.
Join us live this week from the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for The Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to get. Talk about day one of the RNC little political theater fest. They wrapped up with a keynote from the Teamsters General President, Sean O'Brien, which, as you've heard me say, not thrilled with him doing. And look, he is going to be their dancing show pony, who will be ridden all the way till election time. What we saw on Monday night was, I'm going to argue, an endorsement by Sean O'Brien of Donald Trump and the Republicans, his bromance with Josh Hawley, because I don't know if the Teamsters are going to endorse. I don't know if they're going to endorse Biden. I doubt that they're going to endorse Trump, but understand, a non-endorsement in this election cycle is an endorsement of Donald Trump. And what we saw is we saw Sean O'Brien go into the RNC, the Republican National Convention, and talk tough. Look, about two-thirds of the speech, I'm right there with. Go after those vulture capitalists. Go after the business roundtable. Go after, you know, corporate America, the Chamber of Commerce. Go after them. Guns a-blazing. Problem is, that's not what's going to come out of it. Understand what the purpose of the convention is. This is the simple bottom line. The purpose of the Republican National Convention is to help Trump win. That's it. There is no other goal. Republicans, they know what the goal is. The goal is put on the best show. Put your best foot forward for America and say, hey, look at us. And on day one, if you didn't know anything, you would think that they were the party of women and minorities and not a lot of white guys. You would have thought that they were a diverse party until you scan out into the crowd. They're putting on a show for America. And when they danced out, Sean O'Brien, look, he did have good words. And look, I agreed with about two-thirds of the speech. But none of that's going to be remembered. What's going to be remembered is him saying that Trump is a tough SOB. People are going to remember that Trump had the backbone to open his doors where those other people didn't. That's what they're going to remember. And they're also going to remember the fact that, and it's not like the Republicans are going to let us forget, what Sean O'Brien succeeded in doing is that whole both sides-ism thing. You know, that Trump and the corporate media love so much. The big quote was, the American people aren't stupid. They know the system is broken. We all know how Washington is run. Working people have no chance of winning this fight. That's why I'm here today, because I refuse to keep doing the same things my predecessors did. Today, the Teamsters are here to say, we're not beholden to anyone or any party. We will create an agenda and work with a bipartisan coalition ready to accomplish something real for the American worker. And you go, yeah! And then you go, wait a second, explain that? Explain how you're going to get the interests of a billionaire and a vulture capitalist to care about a dock worker or a truck driver or someone who delivers your beer or someone who picks up your garbage? Whoa. You had me in the speech. I was like, yeah. Got the blood flowing. I'm there. Until you go, wait a second. Has that ever happened before? And the answer is no. Look, we don't need magic unicorns. We don't need magical thinking. There are no Republicans who are coming to our rescue. We saw Trump's record. What Sean O'Brien did was to give Trump legitimacy. To say that his labor record isn't that bad. Never mind all the rollbacks of worker protections. Never mind undermining labor unions. Never mind weakening overtime rules and appointments of anti-union officials and delaying workplace safety rules and repealing fair pay and safe working rules, supporting right to work, opposing minimum wage. Never mind any of that. Not enforcing the pathetic labor laws we have. Never mind any of that. Never mind his NLRB doing horrible things. Overturning the Browning-Ferris decision that said, you know what? Yeah, those big franchise companies, they're not responsible for what the little ones do. No. And you could go down the list of all of the things that his NLRB did, and it's all bad. But what Sean O'Brien did is, We're gonna create an agenda, and it's gonna be bipartisan, and we're gonna find my bro, Josh Hawley, who I educated him, and his heart grew three sizes big, and he's now gonna stick it to you the first chance he gets, because if a national right to work bill comes up, trust me, he's voting for it. We've seen these movies before. And this is where my struggle is in this moment. I'm a fan of Sean O'Brien as a labor leader, not a political person. What he and his communications people don't understand is, while he got to say his words, they're going to be used against him. This is a self-defeating situation. You got to say your words. You got to make those people feel a little bit uncomfortable because you were attacking a little bit of what they do. And, they're the ones who did all this stuff, didn't bring up the Supreme Court, did bring up the courts, but didn't point out the fact that it was Trump and the Republicans who packed it with crazy justices that overturned decided law of, years and years. Never mind that. None of that stuff. Just we're gonna work together, forward together. The past, never mind. It's my struggle. And we'll see where it goes, but I think what we saw on Monday night will be something that we see quite a bit from the Republicans. Trump got exactly what he wanted. And you could see by him showing up and surrounding himself with people who were just elated that they were able to trot out their show pony and going to ride him all the way. Want to hear your thoughts. Did you happen to pay attention? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as you know, Donald Trump chose J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio, as his running mate. And I find it interesting that on the day that they announced that J.D. Vance is going to be the running mate, Elon Musk says he's going to give the campaign, what was it, $45 million a month? And I got to tell you, my first thought was, if he's giving the campaign $45 million a month, it's time we start taxing rich people. Also found out that two vulture capitalists, venture capitalists, Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, they're going to be lining the coffers of their fellow venture capitalist, J.D. Vance. So the moneyed interests, the wealthy, the elite that Sean O'Brien talked about, they're looking at, they're lining the pockets of the Republicans. And understand, as my grandfather always said, if a rich guy's going to spend a buck to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. And here to share some thoughts on, the VP vulture capitalist, J.D. Vance, and what it was like in Ohio. I've asked Chris Anderson to come talk with us. Chris is the Mahoning County Chair of the Democratic Party there. Chris, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, anytime, Rick. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here to talk about, the biggest embarrassment in Ohio politics. So happy to have this conversation.
So, let's start with, Sean O'Brien came out and had nice words to say about J.D. Vance. He was out there to help those railroad workers, he's someone you could talk to. I mean, there was some praise there for J.D. from the Teamsters president. What's been your experience?
I think it's funny that a guy like J.D. Vance, who admitted he went to his first picket line at the invitation of Marcy Kaptur, had never been to a picket line before when the UAW workers in Toledo were striking, is getting so much praise from labor, especially given that J.D.'s been on the record multiple times saying that he's in favor of stuff like right to work. We know that right to work is wrong. We think especially at a time where we've seen corporations with record profits not sharing it with their workers, I can't think of anybody that thinks that's okay more than a venture capitalist like J.D. Vance. You're talking about these venture capitalists who came in and they've committed all this money, and it wasn't more than 2 years ago when J.D. Vance got his entire campaign was bankrolled by Peter Thiel. So we're not even 2 years into this guy being a member of the U.S. Senate. Peter Thiel bought him his last seat. Now you see more venture capitalists willing to help buy another one. I can't think of much that would be worse for workers than somebody like that.
I go back to what my grandfather said. If a rich guy's going to spend money, he understands return on investment. He knows he's going to get that back and then some. So the fact that you're seeing all this moneyed interest, flocking to a billionaire and a venture capitalist like J.D. Vance, I think they're expecting something, don't you think?
I mean, especially for the tunes that we're talking about here. I mean, you're talking about Elon Musk at $45 million a month. You're talking about these other venture capitalists pledging $30, $40 million. nobody I know is, you know, nobody I know is giving away $30 or $40 million a month. I mean, they're not giving it. I don't know anybody like that to begin with, but they're damn sure not giving it away for free. So, you know, it's the wealthiest in our country trying to buy themselves more influence.
Yeah. Now the spin and help me with some of the spin, because, you know, he's supposedly a kid who grew up in Appalachia, you know, poor kid, trailer park kid, kind of is what the legend is, pulled himself up by the bootstraps, went to the Marines, you know, got into, I think it was Yale, I believe.
Yeah. He's a Yale educated attorney. You know, so first off, you're never going to hear me badmouth JD's service. There's nobody, I don't think there's anybody that's going to badmouth, you know, JD's service in the Marine Corps. But here's what I will say about JD Vance is he's a guy who quote unquote, you know, he wrote a book to pat himself on the back for pulling himself up by his bootstraps without realizing that the same programs that helped him pull himself out of poverty are the same programs that his party has been attacking for generations, and the same programs that if he had the opportunity to gut in the Senate, you know damn well he would have. So he's a guy who talks about, oh, I'm a self-made man, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, and acts like he didn't get a lick of help, when in all actuality, all the man has ever done in his life has gotten help. He went to college with the GI Bill, you know, which again, he earned as a Marine, but he's over here acting like, you know, he worked his way through college too. Let's call the spade a spade. The guy is a venture capitalist who started a charity centered around the opioid epidemic in Appalachia that did nothing except line his own pockets and his friends' pockets that were consultants, who had some rich friends that bought himself a Senate seat. He hasn't been a member of the Senate for 2 years yet. It hasn't even been 2 years that J.D. Vance has been sworn in. And now he's on this trip to try and become the everyman's vice president. Dude, you're not the everyman's vice president. You're another Yale-educated elite who's pretending that you can relate with people when in all actuality, you didn't even live in the state of Ohio until you wanted to run for the Senate. So, no, as someone who's actually lived through having to pull themselves out of poverty and being a cycle breaker, I take real offense to people like J.D. Vance, because they don't realize that the same programs that they want to cut and the same programs they vilify people for using are the same programs that got them where they are.
No, look,
the guy's a fraud.
No, this is where you and I all share some common ground. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. If it weren't for a lot of those social programs, you know, the housing programs, the food, the ADC, the aid to dependent children, for that stuff, for health care, that saved my life when I was 11, I wouldn't be here today. And I'm happy to pay taxes to make sure that those programs are available for that kid growing up in that housing project that I grew up in. And it's that difference that some people, you know, I got to the top, I climbed the ladder, and it's time we kick it off the side of the building. Instead of saying, how do we strengthen that, make it a little bit easier for people to get to the next step.
Yeah, you know, so I don't remember who said it, Rick, but there's this old quote that says, remember when you're telling people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, some people aren't wearing shoes. And it seems like JD's forgotten that. You know, for a kid who grew up in Appalachia, who grew up as poor as he did, he seems to think that you can solve all things through hard work, when in all actuality, yeah, you have to work hard, but you need a little help along the way. Yeah. And that's where I really differ with JD in terms of how he tries to frame himself. Like, man, just admit it. You don't like poor people. You don't like people who work for a living, because that's at the end of the day, that's what he is. He was a venture capitalist. That's where he made his money from. He made his money by screwing over people who work hard every day that did nothing wrong. You know, and as a member of the Senate, I mean, Christ, his AFL-CIO record is 0%. You ever seen a 0% scorecard from the AFL-CIO? He's never voted for a piece of pro-worker legislation in the 2 years he's been in the damn Senate.
Oh, wait a second. Sean O'Brien said he was all on board for paid sick days for railroad workers.
He's probably all on board, because they're probably going to find a way to tax him on the back end. They're probably going to find a way to deduct it from their payroll somewhere. If he's all on board for sick days for railroad workers, that would be the first pro-worker thing that J.D. Vance has ever done in his career.
Now, the thing is, the thing that's interesting to me is, originally, J.D. Vance came out and said Donald Trump was unfit to be president.
Called him America's Hitler.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first people to say that. How does he get from that place to now on the ticket. And look, he has been one of Trump's biggest supporters recently. How does that epiphany happen? How did that grand conversion come about, do you think?
Because he realized that the death grip that Donald Trump has on the Republican Party is not going anywhere, and that the only way to get anywhere in the Republican Party is to bow down and kiss the man's ring. Let's be honest with ourselves. That's exactly what it is. He didn't have any epiphany. I guarantee you, when you hear him talk behind closed doors, he talks the same amount of crap about him that the rest of us do. It's just that now he needs him, and now his political livelihood is attached to him. It's just another case of where somebody sells out their values to. It's just another case where somebody sells out their values to try and get ahead. I'm from the Mahoning Valley, where we don't appreciate people who are, we call them miracles of medical science. And what I mean by that is it's a miracle that they can stand upright without a backbone. That's exactly what J.D. Vance is.
You know, it's interesting to me. Again, you have these people who have these weird ideas that I don't think a lot of people know about. There's a vein of the Republican Party that's trying to, as we say, put women back in their place. I want to take away voting rights. I want them back in the kitchen, barefoot, pregnant. Taking abortion rights away, and now trying to go after no fault divorce. And I'm pretty sure, isn't he one of those?
Yeah, no, he's a very firm supporter of the Project 2025 stuff. I mean, listen, when he ran against, when he ran for his Senate seat against Tim Ryan, he said that he thought that a lot of America's problems were caused by divorce, and that women who are even in violent marriages. So imagine that a woman is in a violent marriage and you got a guy like J.D. Vance who thinks she should stay married to that guy. That's not, come on. You know, he said that he doesn't believe in things like a woman's right to make her own healthcare decisions. He doesn't, he just wants women to have children and live in the kitchen. That's the world that J.D. Vance envisions for Ohio's women and for America's women now.
One of the interesting things that caught my eye, because the family thing for me, he's got some weird ideas. I mean, obviously stay in an abusive relationship. Absolutely. Make sure they get a chance to kill you. I heard something. He said he was troubled. It was troubled by childless couples or childless people. And while simultaneously being against in vitro fertilization, it seems like this weird kind of, it's a weird kind of place to be.
It's a special breed of hypocrisy is what it is. I've heard the same thing. You know, he talks a lot about like fatherless marriages and things like that being to blame for a lot of America's problems. But like you said, when you have a couple that's trying to conceive, you've got guys like J.D. Vance who think that in vitro fertilization is wrong. Here in Ohio, we just recently passed, we recently just constitution or in, yeah, constitutionalized into the Ohio Constitution a woman's right to make her own healthcare decisions. And that wasn't just about abortion access. That was about access to reproductive healthcare. That was about access to reproductive health care if you're trying to conceive and you're having trouble. It was about a lot more than that. And you had these guys like J.D. Vance that are out there they're trying to perpetuate all of these culture war issues.
What's interesting to me, though, I'll tell you, Chris, what's interesting is, these are the people who tell us that they want smaller, less intrusive government, get government out of our lives, and yet they want to be right in the sheets between me and my wife.
They think government should be just big enough to fit in your bedroom, Rick. That's what they really think.
Now, again, I go back to Sean O'Brien, saying nice things about J.D. Vance, that he supported the sick day thing. But he's not on the side of working people. And I look at one of the things that caught my attention. What happened in East Palestine is one of those things that I think is really kind of telling, because he did delay the timeline for safer tank cars to be put on online that could have helped prevent train spills like the one that happened there. He's part of that. That's part of his legacy.
Yeah. Yeah. You're 100% correct that he owns a piece of that disaster. And I thank God every day that we have a senator like Sherrod Brown who was able to bring him along and help him, and support the Rail Act. I'm incredibly thankful for that. But it's just another case of, he had to be brought along to a position like that, just like Marcy, Congresswoman Kaptur, had to bring him to his first picket line, with the UAW. For a guy, again, I'm struggling to find anywhere that you can call this guy pro worker. I'm going to be honest. I'm really struggling. Like, I just don't get where those comments land. You know, again, going back to the AFL-CIO gave him a 0%. You know, it's hard to imagine that there hasn't been some piece of legislation that he could have supported that would have given him, I mean, Christ, 10%, 20%. You know, at the end of the day, it's still an F, but I mean, it's not a zero.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many zeros there would be there then. Now it's something I have to look up. But here's the thing, you know, I look at this and I go, well, why did Donald Trump choose him? Given the fact that he said, you know, really bad things about him at the beginning, it's not like Ohio is in play. So, you know, what could be the reason what do you think the reason is that Trump put him on the ticket?
Well, so first, Ohio has hands down one of the most competitive Senate races, if not the most competitive Senate race in the entire country. We also have the opportunity to flip the majority in the U.S. Congress by sending a majority of Democrats to the U.S. House. And we're the only state in the country that has the ability to flip its Supreme Court. So we're absolutely a competitive state. But at the end of the day, I think the reason that he picked J.D. Vance is, A, I don't think there's a lot of people lining up for the job. But B, Donald Trump doesn't want to be outshined by anybody. You saw that when you had Mike Pence, who had better conservative bona fides than he did. You saw just, I mean, Christ, his short list of people, any short list where Doug Burgum is on the short list is a pretty pathetic short list.
Point taken.
So, you know, Trump doesn't want to be outshined by anybody. And I can't think of anybody that would outshine a freaking, you know, a snake oil salesman like Donald Trump more than a guy who abandoned his Appalachian roots, who pretends that he's an everyman when he's really a Yale-educated attorney that went on to be a venture capitalist, whose only claim to fame is a book that he wrote to make himself feel good about himself. Like, there's no outshining the Donald in any of those things. And I think that was criteria number one for this job, because it damn sure wasn't experience. He's been a senator less than 2 years, and that's his only time in government.
Yeah, so I'm waiting for people to go, you know, Donald Trump isn't that young. Probably not in the greatest of health. Will he finish his term, and then this guy's president? I think that's a question you got to really, really ask.
It's a terrifying reality to imagine a guy like J.D. Vance could fall up from being a I like your term vulture capitalist. I'm gonna steal it. You know, it's a crazy world to imagine a guy could fall up from there to being the president of the United States, but it's one that you have to grapple with. I have not been shy about the fact, excuse me, I'm getting over bronchitis here. I've not been shy about the fact that I've disagreed with President Biden on a lot of things, but the one thing that we can't disagree with him on is that he's someone who's able to build a team. You know, he surrounds himself with brilliant, qualified people. Look at who Donald Trump's surrounding himself here with. If you're picking J.D. Vance to be your vice president, who on God's green earth would you fill out other cabinet positions with?
Well, there's a whole Project 2025 out there going to do the job for him, Chris. But
right, like is his secretary? Would his secretary of labor end up being like a Koch brother? You know what I mean? Like,
could be Sean O'Brien.
could be Sean O'Brien.
Just
now,
throwing it out there, Chris. As last bit, what should people know? What's the one thing when you go J.D. Vance? What's the one thing we should know?
I will say that the one thing that people should know about J.D. Vance, and honestly, this is one of the things that I find most troubling about this entire thing, is that at a time when our political rhetoric is at the height where we witnessed the travesty that we saw over the weekend with someone taking a shot at President Trump. President Trump had the ability to pick someone who was not going to appeal to those fringes, and he didn't do it. He picked the most hyper-partisan, most fringe nut job that he could imagine. And instead of trying to appeal to America's better angels, he picked somebody who believes that women should stay in violent marriages, that there's no reason that a woman should ever have a divorce, who doesn't believe in workers' rights, who believes that, you know, that if, as long as a corporation's thriving, who cares if the guy, you know, the guy who's making them thrive can't pay their bills. That's the thing that I hope sticks with people about J.D. Vance is he's going to frame himself like he's this guy who came from poor Appalachia and had to do so much to get where he is, without realizing that, yeah, he worked hard and he got some help along the way. But like you said, he would very quickly kick that ladder right out from underneath you, because God forbid you get that same help. So that's the thing that I hope sticks with him, is that he is the antithesis of what someone who supports workers' rights or who supports, you know, I'm a big proponent of, if you're doing everything right and you're working hard, you deserve a chance to get ahead. If you also believe that, then J.D. Vance ain't your guy. That's the thing I hope sticks with everybody.
There you go. Chris, good talking with you. I look forward to talking to you again as this election cycle continues. Thanks so much.
Anytime, Rick. Just give me a call.
Good stuff. Chris Anderson, Mahoning County Chair. Here's the reality. A billionaire and a vulture capitalist. I mean, this isn't even a bad bar joke. A billionaire and a vulture capitalist. They're supposed to be the saviors of the working class? Wow. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
This is 93.5 The Tap. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear and cooler tonight, lows in the low 50s. Sunshine and pleasant again tomorrow, highs upper 70s. And more sun Friday, high near 80. Temperatures continue to warm into the weekend with some slight chances for showers and storms. Highs upper 70s to 80. Currently, it's 59 degrees.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Again, we're talking about Julian Assange, villain or hero. Karen from Madison, you're on the air. What do you think?
I studied that Edward Snowden. You know, maybe I don't know as much about Julian, but I'm trying to learn more. And I just want to thank everybody for helping me learn.
Thank you for being open to learning more about issues and delving into them here on the Civic Media Radio Network. That is what it's all about.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Tuesday, President Biden announced his plan to help working families who are struggling with the outrageous cost of rental housing, as corporate landlords are really honestly and truthfully gouging working families pretty badly. In an effort to lower housing costs, the president is calling on Congress to pass legislation giving corporate landlords a choice. Good choice. Cap your increases in rents at 5%, or we're gonna take away those tax incentives, those tax breaks that you're making so much off of. He also is calling on repurposing some public land so we can build some more affordable housing. About time. Been talking about this for a very long time. And this is good stuff. It's a good start. I think it's going to help move in the right direction. But this whole rental property, this outrageous costs, these corporate landlords who are just basically robbing and pillaging, how can we rein some of this in, and what should we be doing, and how do we get here? That's why I've asked Nidhi Hedgi to come talk with us. Nidhi is the Interim Executive Director at the American Economic Liberties Project, their website, economicliberties.us. Nidhi, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the president's big plan here. He's calling on Congress to pass some legislation, cap rents at 5%. How can he do that? And do you think it's possible that this Congress is going to do anything?
Well, I think that, you know, this is a good thing that the president is doing, because he's clearly recognizing that we have an affordability crisis when it comes to rent in this country. The rent is too damn high, as he has said, and he's calling on like Congress to pass a law where it caps like the rent increases at 5% for like large landlords. People who own like more than like 50 like units, right? These are large residential properties. But I think it's about time that this has happened, because we really do have a crisis in this housing market. And the way we've gotten here is much in the way we've gotten into, you know, across the economy, which is consolidation, over the last, like, you know, few decades, we've really seen like housing rental like units being bought up by corporate like landlords, whether these are like big apartment units or mid-sized apartment units. Instead of having like individuals owning them, we're seeing like corporate landlords owning them. We're seeing single family homes that are available for rent being owned by private equity. You know, they took advantage of the financial like crisis when there was a lot of like floor closure and like just snapped up these homes. And they, one of the results of that is that the rent has increased dramatically. Evictions have gone up and we have an affordability crisis. And I think this is just like one step that the president has proposed, but there's a lot of other exciting stuff that's also happening to address this affordability crisis in the rental market.
Yeah, I mean, the consolidation is outrageous. I mean, I remember seeing a video, you know, about a year ago of the baseball player Alex Rodriguez talking about that. You know, now he's a venture capitalist. Now he's you know, bringing in a whole bunch of money to go out and buy. I think he said he wanted to have 150,000 doorknobs. So he's going to buy up a whole bunch of rental properties because it's continual income. And then, you know, hey, just because he can, you know, willy-nilly, whenever he feels like it, raise the prices if he wants to. And this, I think, is where we are, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is where we are. I think in the last like decade, essentially, what we've seen is that landlords have started to use like software algorithms to set the rent. So, you know, there's been a lot of like conversation under this administration about the how like just prices have gotten too high and like people are price gouging and price fixing is happening in the economy. And it's the same case when it comes to rent. And there's this one company called RealPage, which maybe people have not heard about, but you should hear about this company because it has enormous influence on the rents that are set in the market. And they work with, you know, I think 90% of like investor grade, like multifamily rental housing. And essentially what they do is that they work with landlords who provide them with all this proprietary information about their residential like properties, you know, how many units they have, what's the size, like what's the rent that they're setting, the vacancy rate. And they take that along with like public data that's available, work out the demand and supply for a particular geography, and then spit out some recommendations to landlords saying like, here, you know, here's the rent that you should be setting to maximize revenue, not just for you, but for, you know, all the other landlords we're working with in the market. So it's essentially a cartel and collusion, and the people who are paying the price are, you know, working families across America for whom, you know, rent has increased by in double digits. And not just rent, eviction rates have gone up. That's the other thing that these landlords are doing, right? Is that, you know, they don't really care if you're being turned out, like the turner, you know, they've just, I think, in again, in double digits, you're seeing eviction rates go up because that's the other thing that RealPage recommends is like, what's the vacancy? What's like, let's artificially constrict supply so that you can maximize how much you can get.
Yeah, but what do you
so
say
that's the crisis we're in.
What do you say to going, well, you know, manufacturers have a manufacturer's suggested retail price, the MSRP. You know, how is that any different than what you're talking about in this housing thing? Housing's a product. It's a commodity. It's like anything else. You know, some would argue in a capitalist system, this is part of that. Information is power and they have it and consumers don't.
Yeah, but essentially we have price fixing laws on the book, right? And what RealPage is doing, it's facilitating like landlords to collude with that information that you have. Like you as a landlord have the information about your property, but what RealPage is essentially doing is it's taking the information from like every landlord that they work in a market, like pushing it, you know, through their algorithm and then spitting out what the rent should be for all landlords. And then it's, you know, it essentially most 90% of landlords follow that recommendation. And if they don't, and if they deviate regularly, like RealPage like kicks them out. So the incentives for a landlord to use RealPage and be part of that cartel is very high. So you don't have to like, you know, meet with other landlords in a back room somewhere. You've got software that's doing it for you and like essentially exploiting a loophole in our price fixing laws. So it's not right.
It kind of sounds like something the government maybe should, you know, I don't know, some regulator somewhere should be looking at.
Well, that is like the good news that they, you know, people are like paying attention to this. So, and there's a number of pieces of action that's happening on this. So last year in November, the DC AG filed a lawsuit against RealPage and like 14 landlords here in the Washington district, which is where I live, and rents have really gone up. Then in February, you had the Arizona AG, Chris Mays, also filed a lawsuit against RealPage and 9 landlords who were colluding. And excitingly, there's also a private class action lawsuit against RealPage in Tennessee. And that's progressed a fair bit, where the judge, they've made it through where they've survived the motion to dismiss. The DOJ antitrust division has filed a statement of interest in support of the plaintiffs. So that case is moving along. And the Department of Justice is also taking this extremely seriously. There have been reports that they are conducting a criminal investigation into RealPage's activities. And the FBI conducted a raid in early June of Cortland Management in Atlanta at their headquarters as a part of this. So I think it's great that landlords are being finally held accountable.
No, absolutely. And the outrageous rental increases, because, you know, look, in, you know, 2 years ago, I guess it's 3 years ago now, my daughter, my oldest daughter, you know, she wanted to move out and find a rental property. And the rental prices were just completely through the roof and totally outrageous. So, you know, my wife and I ended up buying a house in town, because it was actually better for us to go and buy something than it was for her to try and find a rental, which is just, you know, kind of insane. But the interesting part is, ever since we bought it, there isn't a week that goes by that I don't get a call from some headhunter going, hey, you want to sell that house? You know, we buy those houses, and you know, it's these rental places that who are you're trying to get another rental property in this market.
No, absolutely. And, you know, you could at least afford to buy. Like, for a lot of people, that's not even an option, right? Like, I mean, I used to live in Oakland, California, and I remember the first year the building management raised our rent by, like, you know, $200. And we're like, okay, we don't want to move. We've just moved to this big city. So we, like, you know, swallow the rent. The next year, they raised the rent by $700, which is not something that we could manage. And this is way back in 2018, which is when RealPage was really kicking off. So I'm wondering if that was a part of this mix. And you don't have a choice at that point. There was vacancy in the building. There was, in fact, a unit for a little bit less, but that was a choice that we were given. So we moved out. So, you know, you don't even have stability as a person, because you're being forced to move out because there's this artificial supply because of this company.
Now the federal government...
With investors... Go ahead.
You finish.
No, I was going to say that with, you know, the other thing that I think is happening is with investors, buying up more and more homes, they can afford to be aggressive. It's the call that you got, they can afford to spend a lot more money, so they can buy up that affordable home supply, wait until you know, whatever rules there are about it being an affordable rate, and then jack up the price as they get it to market rent. So we really do need to not just build more housing, as the president has suggested, but we also need to make sure that this price fixing is in check and that there isn't more consolidation in the market with private equity, you know, owning large chunks of it.
And the reality is, the larger that they are, the more properties they have, the more insulated they are from losing money if there are vacant properties. So they can leave properties vacant long enough, you know, to hold out to get the rental price that they want. Unlike somebody who may own, you know, 4 or 5 properties in town as you know, a side business or their business, that needs those rentals to be filled so that they can make their mortgage payments, how things have been in the past. So it seems to me that this is, again, you know, Wall Street figuring out how to stick it to the little guy. But in looking at this, you know, what's the federal government's role in this? And I think about Section 8 housing. I think about the money that we spend in helping people get into these rentals, and how it's, you know, it's basically gouging the federal dollars. Does that play into any of this at all?
So I think there are a few things, you know, obviously, these cases are going to take some time. There are other things that folks can do in parallel. So one, Senator Wyden has introduced a bill which just essentially bans the use of this kind of, you know, software in setting, rental prices. So that is, a good step. We have Senator Klobuchar, along with a number of other Democratic senators, who just recently introduced a bill, you know, Senator Sherrod Brown, Bernie Sanders, Warren, they were all a part of it, which was looking to, you know, bring in more transparency into this market, like essentially saying that if large like corporate investors or private equity was buying up big chunks of like the housing supply, then they would have to like report it to the Federal Trade Commission and DOJ so that they could actually investigate the anti-competitive effects of the market. So you have that. So that, you know, we do need like bills that make sure that, you know, folks are not taking advantage of it, as well as like you need enforcement actions, which sends a message to, you know, companies like RealPage and the executives who run them that, you know, the antitrust like cops are on the beat and you can't get away with like price fixing. I believe there's also another bill where, you know, Senator Rosen from Nevada is calling on HUD to also investigate this price gouging that is happening and like looking at what's happening in the affordable housing market. So it's sort of an all hands on deck moment to address it.
Something definitely needs to be done. And I've been saying for years, we need a housing program like they had back during the FDR years. You know, I think about my grandparents who, you know, they moved in a community, you know, in a suburb of Cleveland where it was subsidized by government dollars, much like the Levitt towns that have popped up in places. You know, they funded builders to go out and build good, solid, you know, reasonable sized homes that families could afford. And they also helped ensure that there were loans available for people. There was a partnership there that we haven't had in this country for a very, very long time. And I know the right will scream socialism, but it did my grandparents really well.
Yeah, I mean, housing is everyone's biggest cost. So if you're talking about like kitchen table issues and caring about like, you know, working families and workers, then you need to like fix what's happening in terms of housing. And it's really important that you don't build housing. And in the end, it just ends up as a part of the price fixing rental cartel, or it just gets all snapped up by private equity who can gouge it. So you have to make sure that if you're building it, it's actually reaching people, you know, who want it and who need it.
Finally, I got to get your thoughts on the evidently there's a judge who jumped in on the non-competes that we were supposed to be getting rid of. You know, I was celebrating the fact that, you know, Jimmy John's will no longer be able to say that peanut butter and jelly is a proprietary sandwich, that these non-competes that, you know, stifle competition and harm workers' ability to move around and fight for better wages. Now a judge is banning of non-competes?
Yeah, so there is a judge in the Northern District of Texas who has blocked, even it's temporary, this very popular like non-compete rule that has been proposed by the finalized by the Federal Trade Commission, which really, you know, is going to liberate about 30 million Americans so that they can have better pay and better jobs and or start their own businesses. So it's, yeah, that is like a problem in terms of, you know, a judge, like basically like, you know, this is like part of the, you know, the FTC has acted well within its authority to issue this rule. And we really hope that they swiftly appeal it because this is a misguided ruling by the judge. There's another case in Pennsylvania also related to non-competes where the rule is being challenged, and that judge still has to come out with a ruling. But at least the reports say that she was a lot more skeptical and was asking some tough questions. So hopefully, you know, it goes well there.
Again, both these issues comes down to elections have consequences. And the sad reality is come November, you know, we could be going the other way on this, depending on who we vote for. But Nidhi, I appreciate you taking time for us. Good stuff.
Thank you.
Nidhi Hedge, the interim executive director there at the American Liberties Project. Check out their website, economicliberties.us. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at the work that they do. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1934. The Teamster members of Local 574 in Minneapolis were back out on strike. Their strike had begun 2 months prior on May 16th. The striking Teamsters had effectively shut down much of the commercial transportation in the city. One exception was made for some farmers, who were allowed to bring their produce to market. The powerful Citizens Alliance, created to oppose and destroy unions, tried to defeat the strike. The police clashed violently with the strikers, who tried to keep scab drivers from breaking through their picket lines. As the strike entered its second week, other unions began to strike in support of the Teamsters. Clashes between the police and workers intensified. Minneapolis labor leaders sat down with the police and proposed a truce. The governor of Minnesota, Floyd Olson, helped to arbitrate an agreement. The Teamsters won union recognition and the right for all strikers to return to work, as well as a system of recognizing seniority. On May 25th, they called off the strike and went back to work. But soon the employers began to backpedal on the agreement. They claimed that the negotiations did not include the workers inside warehouses and only covered those who drove and unloaded vehicles. Angered, the Teamsters went back out on strike. Soon, violent clashes between the picketers and police broke out again. Two workers were shot in the back and killed. The governor declared martial law and sent in the National Guard to restore order. A federal mediator brokered another settlement, meeting the major demands of the union. It was a major victory for the Teamsters and a major victory for the workers of Minneapolis and beyond. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the reality is, it's about time something's done on the housing front. And look, this is one of those things that, unfortunately, I don't see anything getting done because Congress is going to have to act. And this is where we started today's program off. If you want to have working class issues addressed, you've got to have working class politicians or people who are going to be sympathetic to working class issues. Now, I talked at length about Teamsters President Sean O'Brien and how I thought it was a bad idea to be at the RNC because, look, Republicans aren't the answer. Bridging that gap and go, oh, please come over to this side. That's not the answer. And bipartisanship, we have this fascination that we can get really good outcomes when things are done in a bipartisan way. And I fundamentally disagree with this. And as, President O'Brien was going through his want for this magical bipartisanship, my mind went back to, because as a lifelong Teamster, the one thing that every freight Teamster thinks about is deregulation, how bad deregulation is and how bad trucking deregulation was. The Motor Carrier Act of 1980 was devastating for not just the Teamsters Union, but for the members and for workers as a whole, because it brought a standard of living down like a rock. And it was done in a major bipartisan way. Understand, like a lot of bad ideas, birthed a while ago. This was birthed under the Nixon era. It was banged around during the Ford years, and it was moved around and massaged, and then it got to the Carter years, where there was massive bipartisan support, almost universal support. In fact, in the House of Representatives, only 13 people voted against it, 12 Democrats and a Republican. In the Senate, you had 70 senators vote for it, both Democrats and Republicans. Yes, Jimmy Carter put his name on it, but it was sold as this idea. It's going to help us with our fuel costs. It's going to, it's going to help consumers get, lower prices for, to fight inflation. It was thrown out and sold as all of these things that are going to help workers. And what we know about bipartisanship, what we absolutely know is workers take it on the chin. Find me a bipartisan piece of legislation that benefited working people. I go back and I think of the last real time I remember real bipartisanship, where you had a lot of Republicans and a lot of Democrats You know, you think back to the Clinton years, the welfare reform, that didn't do any good. The telecom bill of 96. Oh, yeah, we got to loosen that up. And what do we have? Mass consolidation and the end of Glass-Steagall. Because, of course, we had learned our lesson. Now, those bills were nowhere near the bipartisanship of the Motor Carrier Act of 1980. But, you know, as I was thinking of this unicorn of bipartisanship, I couldn't help but think about what that one bill has done to an industry. When I started working in the freight business back in the late 80s, it was 85% unionized. So 85% of the less than truckload freight trucks on the road had a driver behind it, carrying a union card, making good family-sustaining wages, with excellent health care benefits, with a defined benefit pension, with job security, with a say and a voice on the job, the voice that Sean O'Brien talked about at the end of his speech, that if he gets ousted from office, he's still got a CDL, he's still got a spot on a seniority list, he's still got a contract that protects him, so he can say whatever he wants because he has freedom, and he can fight like you know what. And that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. But understand, the unicorn that he's searching for, that destroyed lives. So by the late 80s, there were companies going out of business left and right. Because you went from, what was it, something like 20,000 trucking companies in the U.S. in 1980 to something like 40,000 just in a few years. And by the mid-90s, you had, you know, like, what 1.5 million? So that the entry to get into the industry was so low. And all those companies that had their rights tied up and their wealth tied up in their rights, all gone. To give a modern-day example, you think about the taxi drivers in New York City who spent all the money on those medallions to have the right to drive a taxi in New York City, only to have the Uber drivers come in and just crush them. And we've heard horror stories of these taxi drivers with these medallions taking their own lives because they're broke. That's this. So this bipartisanship of which he speak, I'm not buying. I know it sounds good. It does. It sounds good. We should all work for the common good. But the truth of the matter is we're always going to have different wants, different needs. There are going to be separate interests. We're not going to come together. So what has to happen is working people, and this is where I started, we need to be organizing at incredible rates. We need to be getting out in the streets and doing what my grandparents' generation did, demanding better wages, hours, conditions, demanding job security, demanding cost of living adjustments in our contracts. Understand, in this country, you're only about 6%. Unions are only about 6% of the private sector workforce, about 10% of the overall workforce. I mean, there's 90% of the people out there who should be joining and forming unions because they're all complaining about inflation, all of them. And do you know how you fight inflation? Not by blaming Joe Biden or well, you know, they gave a check out. You do that by raising wages, like my grandparents' generation did. You do that by having cost of living adjustments in your contracts so that as prices go up, your standard of living isn't completely eroded. Now, the reality is I look at this Motor Carrier Act of 1980 and the lives that it destroyed. And it was all in the name of bipartisanship. You had Nixon, you had Ford, you had Carter, you had Democrats, Republicans, all over the place, all of them. Just a handful of people on the right side of the issue. And what did we then end up with? Well, we ended up with a just-in-time inventory scenario where now people are living in trucks like caged animals. All so corporate America can make more. So yeah, when Sean O'Brien went into the RNC and he talked tough to corporate America, he talked tough to the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and all those folks, great. Those are good words. Wrong venue. Wrong crowd. Should have been talking to people at their workplaces. Should be talking to people on the street corner. Should be talking to people everywhere you can. But here's the thing, and this is where I started today. The reality, he got his words out. But how are they going to be used? And why, again, did Trump invite him? We know why Trump invited him. So that he can win in November. And he can bring back all of the horrible labor policies that he did while he was president. The question becomes, will you, me, will working people fall for it? Did Sean O'Brien help Donald Trump? Because I don't think he helped anyone but maybe himself a little bit. I do want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.